Calling all KDLL listeners. Would you like to have a direct voice into what you hear on the air? KDLL is seeking members for its Community Advisory Board. The CAB meets quarterly to gather public input and evaluate how well KDLL programming meets the needs of the community. If this gets your ring of approval, contact Jenny at KDLL at info@kdll.org or 283-8433.
Time once again for the KDLL conversation, the Kenai conversation. I'm your host, Shaylin Cochran, and it's all about, well, summertime. Lots of summertime activities. We've got a couple of our friends from the Kenai Watershed Forum in the studio with us this morning, Brandon Borneman and Joseph Roberta joining us. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming in. Good to see you both.
Thanks for having us, Shaylin.
And gosh, where to start? I think maybe a good place to start is just a simple introduction of the two of you, what your roles are at the Watershed Forum, and what you've been spending some time working on as we're getting just right into the real fun part of the summer for you guys. Brandon, we'll start. And I should note here at the top of the show, Brandon Borneman, also a board member here at KDLL, so perhaps a voice you've heard during pledge drives and such things. But start us off here. What's happening as we move into the summer?
Appreciate that, Shaylin. Thanks for having us again. Like Shaylin said, my name is Brandon Borneman. I've been working for the Kenai Watershed Forum for about 7 years now. I started as the GIS and water quality specialist. I've kind of morphed into a project manager. I coordinate the Kenai River Festival, which we'll talk about, which will be the official start of summer for the Central Kenai Peninsula, June 8th, 9th, and 10th. That's mainly my role here now. I support a lot of science projects and restoration projects at our office and try to educate as much as possible. So,
and education, of course, a big part of what goes on with the Watershed Forum during the summer months. And maybe, Joseph, you could step in and talk a little bit about, I know you're running summer camp this year for the Kenai Watershed Forum, and tell us a little bit about that.
I am, and I'm pretty pumped up to be brought onto the team there and to be working as the summer camp director for them this year. I would say they've got a really solid foundation going there for summer camp. I think it's a great blend of both science and activities. And then what we're bringing this year too is we're going to be doing a little bit more of away lessons. They went ahead and purchased a 15-passenger van, so we're going to be able to do a lot more field tripping. And I think that's going to be a really good thing for both the camp and the kids and myself to be able to get them outside and really sort of seeing the lessons that we're going to go over. And right now that's basically like the way we're organizing it is where they would have at least two hiking days a week, probably Tuesday, Thursday. And that gives us a little bit of, rain delay. I mean, it's going to be a pretty full season camp. You know, you got to take the weather that you get here in Alaska, but it gives us a little bit of, leeway. And then, the other days we're going to break that up into sort of a combination of scientific lessons, usually some smaller field trips, kind of closer to town, like on let's say a birding day, we might go out and do some birding over at the refuge or Centennial Park or something like that. And then games, of course, too, because, we want to try to make it fun. And even the games are going to have more of a sort of an educational lesson to them to tie into, kind of what we're teaching them. So if you had something like a big thing we see with a lot of animals is, fragmented habitats, right? Like as more shopping centers go in, more homes get built, more subdivisions get built, more roads go in, the habitat that's there gets smaller and smaller. And even when you preserve it in places like refuges and parks and things like that, they have to cross from one area to another to to get to other animals. And so that's a concept that we want to talk to the kids about, is those kind of conservation things. And I think a really great fun way to do it is to show them those things through games. So if you have a game sort of like a dodgeball kind of game, which all kids kind of like those kind of games, but then you put in sort of the message, you can kind of lay out a grid where, okay, you're a frog or you're a salamander trying to get from where you live to where you need to go breed, the pond. And okay, now there's a road. So we've got kids throwing balls as roads, but then as more subdivisions and more roads go in, we introduce more kids throwing balls. And so it gets harder and harder for them to cross the road. And so it's a really great way for them to have fun, but then also to really like understand that concept, like physically and, you know, mentally understand the concept of how hard it is for some of these species to do what they need to do to survive. And in a way that I think they won't forget. I think it's a real great way to retain that knowledge is through a game like that. So,
and I want to hit on maybe some more of what some of those broader concepts are that you try to touch on during summer camp. But I think we should probably also take some time. And is there still time to register for summer camp? Who's invited? How do we go about all that stuff?
There is, yeah. So what we're doing is, like I said, a lot of it's limited to, we're going to limit it to 13 spots, and a lot of that's because, you know, that's what we can hold
just
in the van.
Logistics,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. And but there's several sessions. The first session begins June 11th and runs through the 15th. And so the way it works is each session's a week long. We've broken it up into age groups so that way the scientific lessons we can give the kids, we can really cater to those kids. You know, for some of the younger kids, like our youngest sessions are 6 to 9. And so that's like, let's say we have an amphibian day plan. So like those kids are going to really be learning like some of the basics of what makes an amphibian different than a mammal or a bird. They could learn concepts like metamorphosis. Whereas for the older kids, like let's say the kids that are more like in that 10 to 12 group, and we even have a 13 to 16, that's going to be kind of below them. So those kids we would kind of cater more towards a little bit advanced scientific concepts. So that middle age group, we might go into a little bit more of like the research. So when we go on like a field foray to try to catch either tadpoles or amphibians, so they can be in the field and they can see these principles that we're talking about, you know, they'll be filling out like a real data sheet. You know, there's a lot of wood frog surveys that happen in our state through UAA, through ADFNG, a lot of facilities. So, you know, we're going to download some of those forms and they're going to see exactly how to fill out that information. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit about how it's used. So they're getting a little bit more of the scientific principles. And so that's a big part of breaking up those age groups like that. So yeah, so we've got the 6 to 9, 9 to 12, and then we have one group that's 13 to 16.
And we can always go to Kenai Watershed Forum's website to register, sign up, and those sorts of things.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. And they're definitely filling up quick. So if there's a session that you want to get in, I wouldn't waste your time on those, because some of them are filling up very quickly.
You know, I'm curious in talking about these very specific and in some cases pretty rigorous educational activities. Is there any dialogue with like the local school district so that there's, you know, for the kids who do participate, there's some continuity? You know, we were talking about this in science class, and then you're going to be discussing these other things over the summer, and the way those tie together, or is are the concepts sort of broad enough that everybody's kind of catching the same thing?
Did you want to speak to?
Yeah, I can add a little bit about our in school program. So the Watershed Forum for a number of years has run a Adopt a Stream program. It's been supported by a number of different funders, various funders throughout the years. And currently, a woman by the name of Jennifer Hester in our office runs this Adopt-A-Stream program. It's our opportunity to get into the classroom and do what you're talking about and kind of continue what Joseph is setting up in the summer throughout the winter season. So it's a great opportunity for us to connect with the school system. And to me, it's one of our most meaningful programs that we have.
Yeah. And Joseph Roberta, Brandon Borneman joining us this morning here on the Kenai Conversation, talking about some of the various programs going on and activities and full calendar of events coming up for the Kenai Watershed Forum across the peninsula this summer. And Joseph, as part of, you know, being camp director, you talked a little bit about this broad concept of like fragmented habitats. And I think maybe when people think about the Kenai Watershed Forum, there's a lot of thoughts about fish habitat and that sort of thing, but some of these programs try to broaden that out and take into consideration much more than just stream bank erosion and fish habitat and get into some broader concepts.
Absolutely, and that's what I'm hoping to personally bring to the science camp this year, or the summer camp, is I kind of want to bring in some of the concepts of the watershed that maybe that they're not so used to or that they don't get in school. Because they do, through a lot of the other programs through the watershed, and even in school, they do get a lot of salmon. And I think just growing up here, you get a lot of salmon. Most families fish either, you know, recreationally or commercially, and so kids I know when I moved here 20 years ago, that was the thing that really struck me as amazing, is that the elementary school kids really knew as much about salmon as, you know, people I was in high school and college with.
Sure.
It was amazing. But there's a lot more to the watershed than just that. And so that's kind of what I'm hoping to do, is talk about some of those other components. Like the one I brought up was amphibians. You know, like there's a lot of people that don't even know we have amphibians this far north. And Alaska has, well, 6 native species and 2 introduced species. We really only have the wood frog here, but that's in itself a pretty amazing thing that we have, you know, that we have amphibians this far north. So we want to talk to them and a little bit about, you know, their place in the, and, you know, the watershed and the ecosystem, because they do a lot, both, you know, eating mosquitoes and things like that that help us, and then also feeding other animals. You know, a lot of the migratory birds that come through feed on tadpoles and frogs and things like that. And so they have an important role. You know, we also want to talk a lot about birds, which a lot of people, you know, I think don't necessarily immediately equate to that. But you got to think about, like, if you drove across the Kenai Flats 2 weeks ago, you saw how important
right.
the watershed is to a lot of the birds that are moving north for the winter and, you know, need that area to pull in and rest for the night and grab some food and keep on moving. And so we want to talk about that. And, you know, it's important to me also to talk about the things that the kids can see in their day-to-day life, and that'll really enrich their day-to-day life, like not just now, but like forever. And one of the big ones is a quote that I actually brought with me, because I love the quote so much I wanted to make sure I actually got it right. And it's by a guy named Thomas Huxley, and his quote was, "To a person uninstructed in natural history, his country or seaside stroll is a walk through a gallery filled with wonderful works of art, 9/10 of which have their faces turned towards the wall." And I like that quote, because I really feel like it sums up a lot of how I think many people just look at nature in general, but certainly a species like birds or trees is like, okay, it's green, it's got leaves, it's a tree, and that might be as far as it goes. Or, you know, it flies, it squawks, that's a bird. And that's great that we can identify a bird, but how much cooler is it when you look out and you see a bird that you know isn't there all year long? And maybe it's a three-toed woodpecker flies in, and it's, you know, this beautiful bird with a bright yellow head, and it's drilling away with its beak. And I mean, this is a bird that's a lifeless, you know, species for a lot of people. People come to Alaska to see that bird.
Mm-hmm.
I think that really adds a lot of meaning, and it really can enrich their life to know that, because if they can learn the birds that are around here, this isn't like learning about like salmon that we see seasonally, or maybe like a bear that you maybe see a couple times a year. Birds are something they're going to see as they walk to the car in the morning, when they're out on the playground. They're going to see these species. So to learn about them and be able to understand them and recognize what they're seeing, I think that's a really important thing to give them. And it's something they'll take through life. I mean, a lot of people who know about birds did learn and retain that at a young age and held on to that. And that's what I'm hoping to give these kids. I don't want to just teach them these scientific concepts, and I really want to like inspire them to like have that sense of appreciation for what we have here and what's around us and for nature in general. I think that's more of how I see my role as the summer camp director.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up birds, because and the Birding Festival just a couple of weeks ago, regular listeners may remember we had Toby Burke in a couple of weeks ago to talk about the Kenai Birding Festival. And that's always a fun show to talk about sort of the birding scene here on the Kenai, and something that we always talk about during that show. And I'm curious what part it plays, again, in some of this outreach and educational stuff through the Kenai Watershed Forum, is the idea that, and birds is a great example of something that you can point to and say, you know, in this place that's changing pretty rapidly in terms of climate and other things, development, all that kind of stuff, there are species that you can see here now that even just 20 years ago, in terms of birds, you couldn't see. And so are there other opportunities like that to sort of point out what has changed? I mean, talking about the fragmented habitats and development, that's a huge way to put sort of a bullet point on how things have changed and what some of those effects are. But are there other opportunities for that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think, you know, the effects that you speak to, Shailen, are quite interesting from a scientific perspective, because in my opinion, they have been happening at a very rapid clip here. Other places in the country have had some of these, experienced some of the fragmentation, had time to quote-unquote deal with it, develop strategies, develop funding, and talk about how to deal with it. We're on the front end of this process where we have an opportunity to potentially influence responsible development, sustainable development. And so we're always constantly striving and looking for opportunities to connect what we do to the real world and to help folks that call the Kenai Peninsula their home. So But yeah, what stands out to me is that rapid clip at which this is happening, and how fast things are changing here is fairly dramatic and evident in everything from the birds to our streams and rivers.
And does that change, does that influence, or does that is that reflected in, I guess for lack of a better term, the curriculum that you bring forward every year? I mean, has that changed over, you know, the Watershed Forum has been around 20 years. I don't know exactly how long the summer camp programs and some of those things have been around, but I would imagine that there's been some opportunity to, just in that short amount of time, to really highlight some things too.
Yeah, I think, you know, the summer camp itself, I believe, is about 7 years young. Don't quote me on that. But we moved into our current office in Soldotna Creek Park in 2011. And it was a opportunity for us to also put a yurt up next to the, if you've ever been to the playground there, it's a wonderful spot. I believe that's where Joseph will kind of base camp his summer camp activities out of. And it's a fantastic place for us to take kids out. The Kenai River is right there. The mouth of Soldotna Creek is right there. So, speaking to the change, I think just having Joseph along and these fresh ideas and constantly giving our staff what they need to be creative and do their job successfully is always been an element of the Kenai Watershed Forum I've appreciated. And I'm happy to see Joseph here with us, and we're excited to have him as a new staff member. So I hope in that sense that just his style brings a little bit of change to that educational outreach.
Yeah.
And getting, you know, to your question, like, I 100% believe that is what we're also trying to impart on the kids. Like, we don't want to just give them information to give them information. We want to give them information so that they can use that as they, you know, get older and again, looking at their life around them. And so there are several things that we can look at with that I'm going to try to show them with the summer camp. And one is, like you said, the birds, because you don't understand sometimes like how little changes can affect the birds. And when you did have the bird show, I was one of the people that called in, because one of the things I noticed is I used to have a lot of woodpeckers in both my yard and my neighborhood. And one of the things that I hadn't put together is we became very firewise. And so we went through and we took out all the beetle kill that was in our yard. We, you know, the whole neighborhood really came together and took it out, which was great. It made it really safe for, you know, if a wildfire came through. But I noticed a lot of the woodpeckers pushed on because they were really, you know, they were, and so that's a really easy, you know, kind of thing to point out to the kids, is that sort of change in, you know, cause and effect and change in effect. And then also one of the things that we're seeing here on the peninsula, talking about, you know, the different changes, is there's a worldwide amphibian die-off happening. Like, and there's a lot of different ideas about what's causing it, and you know, a lot of it's starting to link into a type of fungus that's being spread. And right here on the Kenai Peninsula was the first place, to my knowledge, it might be the only place, but I know it was the first place where they found that fungus here in Alaska. And so, and we do see very high incidence of like sort of deformities and real weird frogs here on the peninsula. You know, you can get frogs that have missing limbs or deformed limbs, sometimes missing eyes. Yeah, it's, and like I said, it's, you know, you can't really just immediately jump and say, okay, you know, a lot of people are, oh, well, is it pollution related? Well, there's a lot of things, amphibians, that can cause, you know, different problems like that. And pollution is one of them. You know, inbreeding is another common thing that can cause problems. Sometimes there's parasites that can cause that kind of thing. Injuries, you know, a bird might have pecked a limb off. So it's being researched right now what's causing that. But in terms of the sheer numbers, we have a lot of them here on the peninsula, and in the refuge in particular, that's where they've been doing the studies. And so that's a really important thing to like kind of clue the kids in on, is that type of ongoing science and how they can play a part in it. Because I think like in our age, right, when we were kids, we looked at like, well, scientists are the ones who are going to solve these problems, and they're the ones who are going to look into these problems. And what we're starting to see more and more is that there's a finite amount of funding available for people to look into these kind of problems. And so we're starting to rely more and more on citizen science to at least provide some of the data for the scientists to then look at and analyze and go through. And that's really important. And that's something that the kids can do. And I think a lot of people in this community are doing right now. And you can do it with the birds, you can do it with amphibians. And getting back to, like I said, we're going to break the lessons apart for some of the older kids. I want to go into them, like some of the different things like eBird an iNaturalist and some of these places where you can report where you see these things and say what you saw, when you saw it. You can upload a photo from your cell phone. You know, usually it has the latitude, longitude. And if you put all that stuff together, like, that's data right there for the scientists. So anything we find with the kids with the frogs, I'm going to show them how to do that, and we're going to do it. So then that data will be there too, so somebody can say, okay, well, this guy looked at this pond and he saw, you know, 15 deformed frogs. Maybe this is a pond that we might want to start looking at to see what's going on here. So like I said, the thing isn't just to, like, kind of give these kids these, you know, sort of worldly concepts with no real application. Like, I want them to be able to participate and understand their role in all of this and take it seriously, because it is a serious thing. And if you can get the kids to understand that, I think that you can get them to care. That's a big deal, because then those are the people who, as they grow up, are going to care about those things too, and the environment and what happens to it. You know, you can't care about something if you don't understand it first. And so that's really important to give them that kind of ground concept.
Yeah. Joseph Roberta and Brandon Borneman joining us this morning on the Kenai Conversation. And we're kind of zipping right along here, and I would be remiss if I didn't throw out the number. 283-8414 is the number if you would like to be a part of the conversation this morning. Again, 283-8414. And Joseph, I'm glad you brought up citizen science. That was something that I wanted to take a closer dive into, because I know that that's going to be a part of some projects that the Watershed Forum is doing research-wise this summer. And it's also something that we're seeing more of. Just a couple of weeks ago, there's beluga counts at the mouth of the Kenai River. There was some citizen participation in that project. The birding world. And what's really fascinating to me that I hadn't thought about until the birding show, and now we're talking about it here again, is this idea of big data helping fill in a lot of those blanks where traditional research simply doesn't have the resources to gather that amount of data to really paint these comprehensive pictures of what's happening on a broad scale. And I don't know, maybe one of you could talk a little bit more about that, what's out there in terms of how big data, which can be kind of a scary term when we think about it in terms of, like, social networking, it can be kind of scary, but it's also turning into a hugely valuable tool for citizen science and for just, again, filling in those blanks a little bit.
Yeah, that was really well put, Shailen. Citizen science is important to all science, and as Joseph was saying, you know, this connection to doing something in your environment, seeing something in your environment, participating in that, it's a big deal. I think it was Aldo Leopold that really set the stage in my world for you can make a difference when you just observe your environment. Simple observations are starting to really stack up and be meaningful to science. And when they're organized well, like the eBird and the iBird thing, it can really be substantial in the long run. And, you know, to speak to some of the programs the Watershed Forum runs, we've for over 25 years monitored biannually the water quality in the Kenai River. You've actually accompanied me on a trip, Shailen, yes, doing some of that sampling. So, and it's akin, I think you even said it that day, to kind of taking the pulse and the heartbeat and going to an annual checkup for the Kenai River. So we're looking at water quality through that, and that whole program relies on volunteers from federal, state, nonprofit agencies, and then local citizens. So we rely heavily on that, and it's one of the longest running data sets for water quality that I've ever seen. We're always complimented on it. It's a service to the entire community to have that data set. We are seeing things like copper and zinc starting to rise, which is, speaking back to the holistic approach of what's going on here and what's changing on the Kenai Peninsula, is you usually see those rises in copper and zinc when you have development. So the more roads we have, the more parking lots we have, the more commerce we have, we're going to start to see those things, and we're going to start to experience those things. So having that data is valuable in the long run, and the longevity of it is substantial. It cannot be overstated how big of an impact that can make to our science. So some other things, you know, we'll be doing this summer, we're going to be counting boats on the Kenai River during the dipnet fishery, this couple weeks at the end of July, and we'll rely on some citizens to come out and help us do that, to spot check some of the science that we're doing, and to just generally participate in science in the watershed in general. So,
and for folks, I learned about that a couple of weeks ago at a Kenai River Special Management Area, I think I got that acronym right, meeting about this new study, and it's to kind of flesh out and add a little bit more detail to the state or the Department of Environmental Conservation's water quality assessment that's due, and you can go to our website to hear all the stories about that. But I'm curious, you know, for folks who do want to participate in that program, which sounds pretty interesting, what kind of a background do you have to have? What kind of training will you go through? Is what sort of rigorous
you know,
science boot camp is this going
to
be?
There won't be much of a science boot camp, to be honest with you. I think everybody is valuable if you just want to come out and help. So, and you know, we're always open to speaking to the public about these things. This is not a, we're not hiding these projects. You know, this is funded by the state. We're a contractor to the state, to DEC, as you mentioned, to do this work. So we like to talk about it. We like to get it out there. What good is science if it sits on a shelf? So it's, you know, taking good science, taking good, you know, measurements out in a field with an instrument is one thing. Interpreting it is another. And then providing it to the public and other entities to use is a whole nother thing. So there's quite a few elements involved in that. And, you know, I just generally would encourage anybody to call us or stop by our office in Soldotna Creek Park to chat about these things. So,
yeah. And you know, I would be really curious, you know, we're talking about, you know, citizen science and big data helping out in providing sort of raw data from much bigger areas than maybe were previously available. And I guess, I don't know if either of you would be the person to ask, but I'd be really curious to know what that concept of sort of crowdsourcing science does on the back end when you're talking about the analytics of it and breaking it down and putting it into practical use. If developments in, again, for lack of a better term, crowdsourcing that science, if that changes any of those things sort of back in the lab when you're doing that stuff.
Yeah, you know, most of the science we do is always under the guidance of what we call a quality assurance protocol plan, so a QAP. So you design this plan, you have a scientific design, really good minds have input into that. So you go into these studies with an idea of exactly what you're going to do, how you're going to do it. However, you know, having this data answering your question is tricky. You know, the federal government has different standards for how they manage their data. The state has different standards for how they manage their data. We, on the other hand, we're more open and public. We like to see that data go to as many users as possible to have the broadest impact and broadest reach. So, yeah, you know, at these different levels, there are different requirements. You know, taking science measurements in the field, again, is pretty standard process. Most federal, state agencies, nonprofit, operate under a very good plan of attack, if you will. However, you know, where that data goes in the long run is really up to that agency and how. So I think there's some ethics issues, you know, talking about crowdsourcing real science data. But I think, you know, what Joseph has talked about and what we've mentioned is this idea of just making observations in your environment. And, you know, that may not look like the scientific method to a lot of people, but it does add value. And we call that traditional environmental knowledge. And, you know, coming from a farming community and family and background in North Dakota, it was evident to me that was just part of the process growing up on the land, was that you were observing things, you were observing changes, you were cognizant of how the environment affects you and changes what you do. And I think the more we encourage people to do that is the better. So, yeah.
To just pay attention. Yeah.
And it's really mining the people who, in some ways, are living closest to those things is why I think it can also be useful in a place like Alaska where we are so spread out and there's, you know, so much wilderness and there's so few people in some of those areas. And so if you've got someone in that area that's lived there their whole life, they can really, you know, tell you a lot about like when they saw those species or when they see those species in a way that it might be hard for someone to just walk right in, especially from outside of Alaska. And like one of the examples that I would use is down in Chichagof Island, there's a type of salamander that's there. And they're starting to kind of look at like how it came to be there, because there's a lot of amphibians down in sort of the southeast area that are there and they're thriving and they're doing great. But they were from back when science teachers used to order science kits, and you might bring in a frog that you ordered from one of the companies and raise up the eggs to tadpoles to show the kids, and then they would just kind of toss them into the swamp at the end of the time when they were frogs. Mm-hmm. And you know, in the 70s, you know, people weren't really aware like what that can do. Getting back to the fungus, a lot of the fungus that we're seeing, we're starting to realize has now been spread through those kind of things, through pets being released and science, you know, projects being released. But there's a lot of people that in some of those communities now where they've been able to go in and ask some of the elders that have lived there, and they're like, you know, before this certain point, I never saw those, and then I saw them from this point on. And getting more and more specific, then as you start talking to some of the people in those communities where they do see them, they're like, oh, well, I remember being in eighth grade, and that teacher brought that type of salamander in that year, and I remember him releasing it at the end of the time. So you can really, you know, use that sort of information to kind of narrow in on like some of these species, where they are, how they came to be. And then the big thing is that, like I said, when you have somebody who's living next to, in that community, next to like a pond where these things are living year round, and they're seeing them come and go and feed, and they're showing up in town at night when they're walking home from restaurants or whatever, it's a lot different to have seen that thing for 40 years and really understand a little bit about its life cycle or where they are, than if you're somebody from the lower 48 who might be up here for grad school and, you know, you've designed this project and you're getting sent out there to look for it. And it's like, that's a huge undertaking to try to just walk into this community where these things live a lot of the time underground or underwater. And, you know, they're really kind of secretive. And so I really think that that's like a really nice way to be able to blend, like, you know, like, again, you know, what the average citizen knows and can offer with what the scientists can then also use and tie in to kind of work with each other to get, you know, to the advancement of the project. And Alaska is a great place for that, because like I said, we have a lot of people that have lived off, you know, off or very near the land for a long period of time that have a lot of that knowledge. And then also, like, I think sometimes too, you know, depending on which source you're using, and he had brought it up a little bit, is, you know, there's different filters in place for that knowledge. If you go to some of the birding things, like sometimes you'll see people will put up a bird and it might be listed as the wrong thing, but very quickly people will identify it as the correct thing. But it's still meaningful to know, and that's an education source for those people to learn that. And because there are species at times that we didn't know about or that we didn't believe were there just through traditional knowledge. And like, you know, before I came to Alaska, I was a zoologist, and one of the big things that zoologists really kept in mind is there's a species called okapi. Are you guys familiar with an okapi?
Not me.
It's a relative of a giraffe, and it lives basically in the central Congo region. It's a very small, it's patterned like a zebra, and they're very, you know, kind of solitary things that live in this dense jungle. And the people who live in that community had for like decades been explaining that this animal lives here, what it looks like. And I think outsiders just sort of took that to be like a Bigfoot or a Loch Ness monster and didn't really take it that seriously. And then they discovered one and they realized like, oh, this thing does exist. And then more scientists came in and started studying them and trying to understand them. And we realized like, oh, no, it is here. There's a few hundred. They're very endangered, but it's a real thing. And so, you know, I think that's an important thing, too, is to understand that like that kind of contribution that people living close to the land can make, again, that sometimes outsiders can't make.
Yeah, and you do hear that a lot. You know, if Brandon, I know that you've been to a number of them, you know, Board of Fish meetings, that sort of thing, where you're presented with mountains of data. But then you also get these anecdotal stories of people who have been there on the scene for, as you said, Joseph, you know, 40, 50 years. And they can really fill in those blanks and say, that might be what the numbers say, but let me tell you about the other 30 years when nobody was taking any data on this.
Yeah, you know, it cannot be overstated how value added that can be to a real, you know, a sound scientific study. I think a lot about when we're doing work on the river, we constantly hear from guides, folks that are spending their entire, you know, days,
their lives
in a lot of cases on the river. There's a lot of valued knowledge that's we're just learning how to capture. And I say we as science. Science is, you know, spent the last 100 years being really good at compartmentalizing itself.
Refining this very prescriptive method. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's very specific. You go to school for a very specific thing. You come out, you study salamanders. That's what you do for your career. You know, now we're seeing this holistic approach to science, which is really refreshing. And it's opening the door to a lot of this knowledge that's been around and should be valued and which frankly was undervalued for a lot of years. And now we're just, as scientists, learning how to be a little more social creatures and talk to people. And that speaks back to the education factor of, you know, what good is this data? What good is science if you're not educating folks, if you're not bringing it to the public, if you're not expressing it so people can understand it. So,
very good. And we're just a little bit past the bottom of the hour here. Time to take a quick break. But joining us this morning, Brandon Borneman, Joseph Roberta from the Kenai Watershed Forum, talking about some of the educational programs and a lot of fun broader science stuff in general this morning. A lot of fun. But when we get back, we'll take a quick break and we'll talk about some more of the events coming up this summer in a couple of weeks. Kenai River Fest coming up, and I'm also going to be interested to hear about what some of these field trips are around different parts of the peninsula as well for summer camp at the Kenai Watershed Forum. That and more all coming up on the second half of our program after this. Stay with us.
This is Vivian. And we're the staff of Northern Lights Therapeutic Tape Advantage in Kenai at 610 Atla Way, Suite Number 4, 907-690-2010. We will be donating 30% of our proceeds from now until June 30th. And we would like to encourage other businesses to participate with us in a challenge to help raise money for KDLL programming. We are asking that businesses donate a percentage of their proceeds up until June 30th, and the public can come by the businesses and purchase goods and services for KDLL programming.
KDLL has until June 30th to meet our federal match requirement. Thanks to Northern Lights Therapeutic Tape Advantage for helping us get there. If your business would like to participate, give us a call at 283-8433.
And thanks for staying with us on the Kenai Conversation, talking about, kind of all things science a little bit this morning with some folks from the Kenai Watershed Forum, Brandon Borneman with us, Joseph Roberta as well. Joseph is running the summer camp this summer for the Kenai Watershed Forum. Brandon is a project manager, GIS specialist, all-around science nerd, I guess is a proper way to say it. And we've kind of been bouncing around a little bit. Something that you talked about a little bit earlier, Joseph, in terms of the summer camp, and something that I'm interested in is being able to get some field trips, because, you know, something that we can pat ourselves on the back and say what a unique place this is to just sort of park it and study, you know, the area where you're at anyway. But now with an opportunity to get out and about a little bit, what are some of the plans this summer for some field trips and to go out and to do some studies, make some observations that way?
Well, I touched on a couple of them. So the way it's working right now is we're going to leave Monday, Wednesday, Friday as kind of days where in the morning they get sort of the scientific lesson and we play some games in the morning. And in the afternoon, we'd go out on a field trip that would reinforce whatever that was. So let's say like right now, Monday might be a birding day. So in the morning, they'll come in. We'll kind of go over a lesson where we explain like, you know, how birds are different than other animals, what makes them unique. We'll talk about characteristics for identifying birds and what some of the common birds they can see here are. You know, we can look at coloring sheets and different things for the little kids so they could color them in, and that really drives home the colors of, you know, some of the different species for identification. But then in the afternoon, we want to go out and see if we can look for some of those species. So like I said, we could go right there in Soldotna Creek Park. We could go to Centennial Park. We could go over to the refuge. So those will be the Kenai Flats, Kasilaw Flats. Those will be for close sort of field trips in the afternoon to see some of the things that we're talking about. On our amphibian day, it'd be the same thing. In the morning, we'll talk about what amphibians are. And then in the and then the afternoon, we're going to go out and probably survey some ponds in different areas. And that might be out like Swanson River Road or some of the areas where we've talked about where we've been able to use some of the resources available to isolate ponds. And I've been doing a lot of pre-surveys already to try to find some of the ponds to make sure that the kids can get out there and see something. And I mean, you know, nature's nature, so you can never guarantee you're going to get out there and see something. And we've had a really weird, cool spring. So even compared to past years, I'm still seeing like eggs and tadpoles much later than what we should be seeing, which is good and bad. You know, the kids will get out there. But even some of the ponds where I've hiked out to and didn't see any amphibians, it was a bust on amphibians. You know, I'll see a beaver or I'll see some loon or something like that. So those would be the short field trips. Friday, we're probably going to do more of a sort of a planetary protection lesson. And so in the morning, we'll go over some of the big things with plastics and how plastics can be both a good and bad thing in our society, and some of the harm that's caused through either entanglement or ingestion, some of those common things, and what can be done in the area to do that. And then in the afternoon, we'll go out and we'll probably do a little bit of like a beach cleanup after one of the, you know, the dip net fisheries or something would be a great place to hit that. And so the kids can see in action, like, okay, this is how much harm these plastics could have done. And we're going to be actively taking part in cleaning that up. And then we'll tie that into probably like a little beach bonfire and roast some hot dogs and s'mores so that it's, you know, it's also fun.
So that's also fun, yeah, because you have to have some time to watch the sun go down and reflect a bit on your day, right?
Sure.
And I should mention, you're talking about some studying of amphibians. I don't know if it's been coming across the airwaves. We've got actually a third kind of a silent partner so far on the show, but Joseph, would you like to introduce your daughter?
Oh, sure. This is my daughter, Lynx. And Lynx is, as anybody knows, is definitely like my partner through so many of the things that I do, certainly any of the outdoor things. She's a real outdoor kid. So she's been helping me with all of the pond surveys that I've been doing, trying to isolate some ponds that have really high numbers of amphibians and frogs. And we even collected some eggs and we're raising those into tadpoles right now so that the kids in the summer camp can see the tadpoles, just in case we do get out and we hit a pond that's a bust for whatever the reason, they can still see those things and see them up close, because tadpoles are really amazing creatures in a lot of ways. I mean, we don't have a lot of animals that live that sort of double life of, you know, part of it fully aquatic and then part of it, you know, terrestrial. And, you know, it's just such a neat thing to see their mouths develop and see their eyes develop. And right now, the stage that they're in, you can see through them and you can actually see their heart beating and developing. And so Lynx has been a big part of doing that. Lynx, you want to talk a little bit about what we've been doing at home? What do you think of the tadpoles?
I love them and they're doing really good.
What do you help do?
I help clean them out and help doing nail, help feeding them.
What kind of stuff do they eat?
They eat lettuce and fish food.
And fish food. What, are they slimy?
Yes.
Do you like that?
Yeah.
We've got a future scientist on our heads.
Definitely. Right
there. That's great. That's fun. And this, so being able to take this kind of stuff home, and this isn't just for you, but for anybody, being able to take this stuff home is pretty important in keeping those broader concepts that we've also been talking about, keeping those sort of at the forefront as well. Yeah. So we're down to, we've got, oh gosh, we're blowing right through this thing. One of the things that we tagged you for, Brandon, one of your many roles that you play at the Watershed Forum, is putting together the Kenai River Fest, and this is an event that's turned into quite the event, kind of a showcase deal for you guys. And tell us what's going on this year.
Yeah, so it's the 28th annual Kenai River Festival. It'll be June 8th, 9th, and 10th in Soldotna Creek Park. right by our office there. The city of Soldotna is a major partner with us. They've done a lot of improvements to that park. We were just talking about it yesterday, how far that park has come in 7 years that I've been here. So excited to have it back there. Excited to have all the activities, listening to Lynx. It gets me really excited for the Kids Zone, the Kenai River Festival Kids Zone. So we have numbers and numbers of activities for kids to participate in. And you're also going to want to mark, we have an eagle release from Bird TLC is coming down from Anchorage.
Hold on.
Releasing a live eagle.
So from like an adult eagle, a baby eagle, how does this work?
It is an adult eagle. It'll be Saturday, June 9th at 2 p.m. in Soldotna Creek Park. You probably can't miss the crowds moving around this little box. I think it'll be in the southeast corner, or southwest corner rather. But anyway, I believe the eagle's from Kodiak.
Was rescued or?
It was injured and okay. We've been given a couple. We had one coming and that one wasn't ready. Something happened to it. So don't quote me on it, but I believe it's a Kodiak eagle. They have too many eagles in Kodiak. And so it will not go back to Kodiak. It'll probably find a home here. So,
yeah.
It's an exciting thing for us.
Well, that'll Bird
be cool. TLC has been there for a long time. They often frequent the festival in the kids zone. But the eagle release is something very special for us. So yeah. I want to thank Tammy Murray in our office for making that happen. So yeah. And lots of other activities that weekend. So
let's go down the list.
Yeah. So June 8th, 9th and 10th again, June 8th, we're going to run from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. with live music, art and food vendors. We have the most art vendors we've ever had, and I believe the most food vendors we've ever had. So lots to do, lots to see, lots of places to spend money, lots of places to get festival food. Saturday, June 9th, we're going to start the day with our Run for the River. A lot of people know about the Run for the River. I'm not going to go too far into it other than the registration is still open. So if you visit,
will you be running?
I will not be running. If you see me running, you should be running too. There's something seriously wrong somewhere. Something is probably on fire if I'm running a 10K. Anyway, you're more than welcome to still visit our website, stop by our office, go to our Facebook page. Lots of links to sign up for the Run for the River. It's a very popular run. Saturday, again, that's how we're going to start the day at 8 o'clock in the morning in Soldotna Creek Park. Kids Zone activities open Saturday at 11. They run till about 5 p.m. And then we're going to have live music in a beer and wine garden running simultaneously both Saturday and Sunday, about 11 to 5.
And so, how about the band lineups?
Oh, I'm very proud of the band lineup. This is the first time I've organized the bands on my own, the entertainment schedule. So very excited to offer kind of an Alaskan slate of bands. A lot of these bands have members that have played with one another in various ways, and they'll probably get together on stage and have some special moments where they kind of play with each other in different sets. So super excited about it. I can't list everybody right now, but you know, big headliners Saturday night are Super Saturated Sugar Strings and the Hope Social Club, with Conway CV opening and emceeing for those two bands. And then Friday night, we're going to have the Denali Cooks, Big Fat Buddha, and the Ledgers opening up our festival. So super excited about that. Come have a beer. Come dance a jig in the Soldotna Creek Park, June 8th, 9th,
If you have any energy left after the Run for the River. Now, what is the River Fest go? I mean, this is your big fundraiser for the year, and I mean, it's more than just a big party.
Yeah, you know.
Although it is that.
To us, it's free to the public. It's educational, it's family orientated, and that's our focus. Okay, so it's, you know, to us it means celebrating the Kenai River, official start to the summer, a fantastic way to educate folks on the Kenai River and its many watersheds. And it is, you know, in a sense, a lot of people think it's a big fundraiser for us, but you know, to be honest with you, Shaylin, we put about $60,000 into it, and we take out about $60,000. So we're lucky to break even on the festival. That's not the point. We're just happy to be a part of this community, putting this on. You know, the whole festival operates with the help of community sponsors, numerous volunteers, and then, of course, our fantastic staff at the Kenai Watershed Forum that spend most of the year setting aside from time to time their own projects to help organize this festival.
And I did want to take a couple of minutes because we've talked so much about the summer camp program, some about the Riverfest, and Joseph, or maybe one of you mentioned Adopt a Stream, but there's also Streamwatch, some other programs that are happening. Maybe you could touch briefly on some of those.
Yeah, so the Watershed Forum has been operating a Streamwatch program that came from the Chugach National Forest on the Russian River since 2011, and we're happy and excited that this program is remaining strong and actually burgeoning. It's growing. It's such an exciting program. A woman by the name of Alice Main in our office organizes. She's a Streamwatch coordinator, and she does a fantastic job getting citizens out, volunteering to pick up trash, to help clean up their watersheds, and to educate users of the watershed, whether it be fishing or dip netting or other uses. They're just fantastically always out there and visible, and it's just really a wonderful program that just is growing leaps and bounds. And this year we've actually been grateful enough to be able to expand that program from our sites on kind of the lower middle Kenai River to sites on the southern peninsula near Homer. So some of the state park access points at Anchor River, Nanilchik, and Deep Creek. So we're very excited.
Yeah. You know, in just the last couple of minutes here, I'm curious, a lot of the work, you know, sort of boots on the ground work that the Watershed Forum has done over the years, you think about, I know that there's a ton of culvert replacements, and then you talk about programs like Streamwatch, but it's striking me that perhaps education is becoming more and more maybe a bigger part of that pie all the time for the Watershed Forum. And I'm curious, you know, in the nonprofit world, in the grant writing world, is that well supported? Are there resources out there to support the sort of educational programs that the Watershed Forum is putting on and trying to focus on?
Yeah, I think, you know, Joseph alluded to the fact earlier that, you know, funding is hard to find, whether it be science, whether it be restoration, whether it be education. So kind of under that same umbrella, we're seeing, you know, state and federal agencies starting to tighten up their budgets, which, of course, trickles down and affects 501c3s and what we do. So although it is becoming a, you know, and rightfully so, an integral part of everything we do, it is a challenge to constantly keep it funded. You mentioned our Adopt a Stream program. We're always looking for support for that program. I think it cannot be overstated how valuable it is to do what Jen Hester in our office does, going into classrooms, interacting with kids, teaching kids about holistically about their environment and where they live. Joseph taking kids out and connecting them to their environment. So yeah, it's, you know, it's a challenge. That's really all that it is to it. So,
but a rewarding one.
It is.
Very good. Well, we're just about out of time, gentlemen, but I want to thank you both so much for coming in this morning. And did we get everything? You both came in with lists, so I just wanted to make sure we got to everything.
I will mention, you know, at the River Festival, June 8, 9, 10. So, the community knows about this festival. We hope everybody comes out, enjoys themselves. We've ordered the best weather possible.
right.
And, you know, we've got some big sponsors. Snug Harbor Seafood and Alaska Salmon Alliance have, again, donated salmon for our salmon booth. So come have a world-class salmon dinner the first of the year.
All right, very good. Brandon Borneman, Joseph Roberta, and Lynx Roberta as well. Thank you so much all for being here. It was a great chat.
Thanks, Shaylin.
And you have been tuned to the Kenai Conversation here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. If you missed any portion of the conversation, we have that posted online at our website, kdll.org. I'm Shaylin Cochran. Have a great day.